You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day is casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, November 14th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is a three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the heart of downtown Brooklyn, in the city of New York. I don't know. We're in the borough known as Brooklyn. I don't know. I'm still working on it, folks. It's casual Friday, so I'm not gonna pretend like we've got that nailed down. And as it being casual Friday, you know what that means. Cliff Schechter will be joining us to look back on the week in news. Also on the program, friend of show, ostensibly providing me with a movie recommendation. Also to talk about her blockbuster interview. What was it on? This American Life? Tina Dupuy will be joining us. Syndicated columnist. Also on the program today, President Obama doubling down. Not only announces that he's about to take executive action on immigration, but also slams the vote for Keystone XL. Treasury Department, fed up with Arne Duncan, says, we're going to run our own pilot program to see if we can get those blood-sucking leeches, those debt collectors of student loan, we can cut them out of the picture. Also on the program today, new polling shows that the limited number of people who do get insurance through the Affordable Care Act exchanges seem to be happy with it. And Elizabeth Warren now in a leadership position, a newly created leadership position, the Democratic Senate caucus, and Don Blankenship, Massey Energy CEO, after a four-year investigation into the explosion which killed 29 miners in a Massey-owned coal mine in West Virginia, is indicted on multiple counts of operating that mine, knowing there were safety violations, and then trying to cover it up. And then the final question of the day, will Mark Udall, outgoing senator from Colorado, read the Senate CIA torture report on the floor of the Senate? All that and more. A lot of news today, folks. And later in the program, we will also have sound from Alex Jones commenting on net neutrality. Always. Wow, Alex Jones, FreedomWorks, they've all come out against net neutrality. What a shock. What a shock. And, of course, we all know why. And we're not going to say why. We'll wait for Alex Jones to say that. Folks, a little bit of house cleaning. We need your support. And in the next week or two, probably after Thanksgiving, I would imagine, based upon the pace in which we move here, the glacial pace in which we move, we will have a fundraiser. But to help us get set up in this new space and to give us a proper video system and maybe expand a little bit, et cetera, et cetera. In the meantime, you can support this program by becoming a member. You'll listen on a daily basis or a semi-daily basis. It's pennies a day. You can become a member for $10 a month. Support the program. Over the course of a year, it's $120, just in case you're not very good at math. And think about, you spend more than that on your cable any given month. So for pennies a day, not even less than a cup of coffee, less than half a cup of coffee. In fact, depending on where you buy your coffee, it's less than like a quarter cup of coffee. You can support this program. Also, speaking of coffee, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Look, if you have a friend or a family member who is liberal, this is a great gift for them for Thanksgiving or for Christmas or Hanukkah or Eid or whatever it's going to be. Get them Just Coffee. You get 10% off using the coupon code Majority. You don't have to tell them that, but you can get them the Majority Report blend. Turn them on to the show. This is a no-brainer, folks. Get on it. All right, we're going to take a break. Oh, and also one more thing. I said this on the member show yesterday. If anybody out there has an old iPad, like iPad 1 or 2, sitting around that they can't even update to, the last three iOSs because of the beautiful built-in obsolescence of Macintosh products, send it to us. We can use it for soundboards. That way Matt's not struggling around trying to look at an old iPod, like from, I don't know, like the... The 1980s, right?
It's an old iPod, yes.
That we fire music from. And that's why he never changes up the music, supposedly, because it's too hard for him to scroll. But if we can get him a nice little iPad, we can do like a little soundboard situation. So if you can, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com if you have one sitting around. So, folks, if you're a regular listener of the program, you know we generally have Cliff Schechter on up next to reflect on the week's political news, but we're doing a little something different today. I'm actually recording this after the live show. Generally, we just record the live show and then play it as is. But the interview that we have with Tina Dupuy later in the program, or what's actually going to be next, it turned into something that we didn't really anticipate. She had an interview, or there was a story about her on This American Life, and you know we were going to touch on that, but And then go on to, you know, some of the political stuff that Tina has written. She's sort of a friend of show and certainly a friend of mine. And then we started talking about the story that she told on This American Life, which I knew some of. And it turned into a much longer and more interesting interview than I had anticipated. So we're putting that up first, and then about 45 minutes later, we'll be running the Cliff Schechter interview. It's an extra long show on this Friday, so enjoy. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, Tina Dupuy.
I want you to know. Yes.
We are back. Ladies and gentlemen, Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is always a pleasure to welcome to the program syndicated columnist, bon vivant, I guess, sort of. Apparently, atheist apologist, based upon your last column. And now, it's like This American Life star.
Yeah.
Tina Dupuy. Hello, Tina.
Hi, Sam. How are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Can't complain.
I understand you started drinking again.
Yeah. Yeah, you heard that rumor, too?
Yeah.
There's something about going on National Public Radio and confessing all of your... all of the darkness of your childhood that,
informs
the masses.
Now, we will get to that. I mean, well, first of all, and I'll tell people what we're talking about, but, and I knew a little bit about that stuff. I mean, we've talked about it in the past. We've known each other for a couple of years now. And it occurred to me, like, wait a second, aren't you writing a book about this?
Yeah.
Okay.
I am.
All right.
I am. I mean, this has been one of those projects where, like,
did I just break some news?
10 years. No, you didn't.
Oh.
I am.
All right, forget about it.
In your face.
No, it's been one of those things where, like, every time I because I grew up in foster care and I, and my parents were in like this weird, religious cult, and so you'd mention that and people go, oh my god, you need to write a memoir about this, but for the last decade or so, I've been kind of enjoying people just not knowing about my business. My hate mail is kind of hilarious. I get a lot of people who say that I'm just another, just another entitled liberal, rich liberal. I get that a lot. And I just think it's funny, because I've been able to, because I have the privilege of just passing and not having to tell everybody about, my, where I came from. So, and I kind of didn't want to blow that, but then decided to go on
American Life. The strategy didn't work when you went on This American Life, I can tell you that. Now, for people who have not, and we will link to the piece at This American Life, but it was a story. They organized it into sort of like turning points, or what was it? What is the... I can't remember what it was. Like there's a general overall theme with these stories.
The leap.
The leap. And for you, it was after, 20. I don't want to date you, but decades.
Yeah.
Because you thought.
Oh, you don't want to date me, Sam?
Well, no, you know what I mean. Of course.
Oh, you don't want me to appear old.
Right. Well, go ahead. You tell it.
You want me to tell it? My parents were, dressed like hippies, but punished like Calvinists. So, essentially like an attitude problem, I was put in, I was 11 the first time I was put in a mental institution just for like skipping school. By the time I was 13, I was put in juvenile hall, and just from like a bureaucratic snafu, my file was lost, and I was supposed to be there over a weekend, and I ended up being there for nearly 2 months, and just forgotten about, and didn't know if I was ever going to get out. And so religious people would come in, church groups would come into juvenile hall, and they would say, if you do what we do, you'll have everlasting life. And AA groups came in, and they said, if you do what we do, you never have to come back here. And I was like, done. I'm in AA. When I was put into foster care, they would take us to AA meetings, and they were like, relate to the feelings inside. Relate to the feelings that people were saying in meetings. And I was like, okay. And people talked about being from a dysfunctional family, and I was like, that's definitely me. And they talked about feeling dead inside. And I came from an abusive family, and I was like, that totally is me. And so I was like, okay, then I'm an alcoholic. And I just kind of assumed that that was my issue. And I became kind of AA famous, and I'm published in AA literature. Do you go to an AA meeting? There's a pamphlet that says young people in AA, and my story's in there. And I was speaking all over the place. And at 24 years sober, I thought that maybe I wasn't actually an alcoholic, that I could be mistaken about this. And so I decided to actually drink. And that's what the story is about.
All right. And I want to get to that point where you, what made you actually think that at that point? I mean, that you might not be an alcoholic, but just to, you know, to be clear, when you were a kid, I mean, it sounds like your parents were, I mean, I don't know if forcing alcohol on you is the right way to put that, but you know, I mean, I have a kid, I let her, occasionally, a 9-year-old, occasionally have, like, you know, maybe once a year, a sip of wine. But you were drinking alcohol as a kid, right? But it just wasn't that you were, I mean,
yeah.
I mean, so you had access to alcohol as a kid, but it wasn't that you were drinking too much. It was just like, you didn't know what the definition of someone who was an alcoholic was, short of those emotional reactions.
Yeah, I think they changed in young people AA. When I got sober, they kind of changed. They moved the goalposts. So it was more of like alcoholic behavior. There was an emphasis on, you know, if you were angry, that's alcoholic behavior. If you, you know, were like, were discontent, that was alcoholic behavior, and it didn't really matter. You know, you didn't have to drink in order to be an alcoholic. You just had to, like, basically have bad feelings. And so that's what, when they were like, well, you just, if you relate to the feelings, then you're an alcoholic. Well, you know, I mean, it's, the human beings are not that complicated. I mean, I can share an emotion with an alcoholic. I can share an emotion with you know, probably every human being on the planet. So, like, it was just kind of like this weird kind of circular, it gets to this circular logic where, because I'm convinced I'm an alcoholic, then everything that I do is therefore alcoholic behavior. And there was no getting out of that. But yeah, no, I was exposed to, my mother is a drug addict. And so I did, like, in AA meetings, I would share that I did, I had a pot laced with PCP when I was 7. And in AA meetings, I would share that, like, I went to the street corner, you know, and scored some PCP. And I was like, my mother gave me that. You know, and they were like overly permissive, and then like really, and at the same time, then they would get these like really harsh punishments. So it was really confusing. So yeah, no, I was exposed to alcohol and drugs from a very young age. But I was the one that was, you know, sent away.
And this group,
thankfully, I mean, that saved my life. Being in foster care saved my life. I mean, if I didn't get away from those people, I don't know what would have happened to me. You know, foster care was where, you know, I was in school and I found, you know, a love for literature and politics. I was, you know, I figured out that I had an ability to write. There were a lot of fantastic things that happened to me in foster care.
And what of your brother? You had a younger brother.
I do. Yeah. I have he's, you know, referred to him as an Irish twin because he's 14 months younger than I am.
Do you still have a relationship with your parents and your brother?
No, actually, This American Life has to go through a really rigorous fact-checking process now in the wake of the Apple story a couple of years ago. For fans of the show, you'll remember that. But so their fact-checking process is insane, and they had to not only talk. They were talking to my birth parents, who I haven't talked to in, you know, years. I just have no interest in having a relationship with them for any reason.
And what about your brother?
He sends me pictures of his kids. You know, I mean, we're on talking terms. I have his phone number in my phone, which is more than I can say for, you know, our parents.
Did This American Life find out that you never worked in a Chinese factory?
Yeah, they did. They discovered that.
So they blew that.
Have no carpal tunnel. Yeah, I know. They did.
And so, I mean, how did, All right, so let me ask you this. So what was that moment where you said, hey, wait a second, maybe I want to drink? Like, did it start with, like, I want to drink, and then, hey, wait a second, maybe I'm not an alcoholic? Or was it, maybe I'm not an alcoholic, I think I want to try and test this out?
Yeah, no, it was a lot more. I mean, it probably started, it was about a five-year process where, you know, just kind of, you know, I was sitting in meetings kind of, you know, thinking the things that were, you know, for example, in A and elsewhere, I hear this all the time, people will say, you know, everything happens for a reason, right? And one day I realized that that's actually not true, that we're pattern-seeking people and a species, and everything happens and then we think of a reason for it, and that's not actually, you know, when people say that, it's kind of like this passive thing of what you say when bad things happen, but it's not actually true. And if that's not true, then there's, you know, I could have ended up in A by mistake. And then I talked to a colleague of mine who was 17 and she was sent to rehab. And turns out that she isn't an addict. She has Asperger's and she was misdiagnosed. Mm. And I thought that was really interesting. And then I just, you know, it was a kind of rethinking this and then putting it away. It really did take 5 years and just kind of being curious. And then I talked about it to death with my husband. And then finally it was like, okay, well, I'm going to have to actually, you know, in order to prove this, and they say that in AA, I mean, they don't say that you have to be sober forever because, you know, I mean, there are people who are afraid of drinking, which is another thing. But in AA, they say, you know, the way, if you don't think you're an alcoholic, go and try to drink. And so I did.
That's interesting. So in some ways you rejected sort of the ideology, or at least the sort of the within AA, I mean, that notion of everything happens for a reason. That's right. I mean, it's nice that people say that, but usually
right.
It's just, we just rationalize why it happened.
You got it.
And
precisely.
When one door closes, guess what? Another door does not automatically open. It's just that you
right.
might be looking for doors, and so you may pry one open.
Right.
I don't want to freak people out here, but in terms of physics, one door shutting does not necessarily cause another door to open. It just doesn't happen that way. I mean, I guess if you're in a very tight room where there's air.
Oh, my God, you're a heretic.
Yeah. And so that was the beginning of the end, right? Were there other sayings in there? Were there other sort of like things that you started?
You know, I started.
Because it sounds like you were rejecting the sort of like social setting. And that took you down the road to saying like, hey, maybe the fundamental premise as to why I'm in the social setting is wrong, which doesn't necessarily follow, right? I mean, people could say like, I can be sober without having being told that there's a higher power, or I can be sober
right.
without having to give myself, I can just go be sober. But that's not the route that you followed.
Yeah, I was actually questioning if I was in fact an alcoholic. I mean, I heard other people who were diagnosed, misdiagnosed, but also I started reading about the troubled teen industry. And my mother got a book called Tough Love. And that's when I started being sent away and having like in ridiculously horrible punishments for like seemingly normal behavior. And what they have in those, my colleague, friend of mine who wrote a book about this called it parental absolution. Right. So you have a kid who's like kind of acting out. And I mean, I had like, I just as an example, this has been my week, Sam. There was an expose of the women who are walking around the city with babies and begging for their like begging with children and infants on their hip. And there's like this, and they found out that they're actually like kind of coordinated and they switch kids. And so there's been a little bit. Yeah, I think NBC New York, the local NBC affiliate, has been investigating this. Well, that was me in the 70s when I was a baby. My mother was one of those people with me on her hip on the streets of Manhattan, selling literature for the cult that we were in. And we did that for 9 months until we went to Europe. in New York City. So, like, I was reading that, and I was like, that's a horrible way to have to raise a child. And I was like, oh gosh, that's me. So, like, I didn't exactly, you know, my childhood was really kind of rocky, to be euphemistic about it. And so, my mother found this book, Tough Love, and what it offered her was a support group where they said things like, look, your kid is spoiled rotten. You know, it's a decadent world and you've done nothing but love them their entire life. And the only way that they're going to get better and the only way that they're not going to end up being a dead crack whore is by the strictest, harshest punishment imaginable. And that's the only way, you know, and through the, and it's like this very like puritanical idea where, like, you know, through suffering is salvation. And this resonated with my mother because she didn't have to do anything. It was like the easiest possible thing to just send me away. And that's what ended up happening. So as I was reading about the troubled teen industry, and this still, Romney, this came up during the last campaign, because Romney is kind of connected to the wilderness camps in Utah, the for-profit wilderness camps in Utah. But as I was reading about that stuff, I started realizing that maybe I was just kind of caught up in this like moral panic than if I were truly an alcoholic. And there was one way to prove this, and right, it was by actually, you know, having a glass of wine, which turns out, I mean, and now it's like stupid because I've thought for the last 24 years, I thought that I was an alcoholic, which means that I can drink copious amounts of alcohol. And turns out I get like pretty buzzed on half a glass of Chardonnay and really can't drink all that much, which is
so
like,
you're lightweight.
Embarrassing. Oh, it's embarrassing. It's so humiliating to like, you know, think that like I'm a badass and be the exact opposite of a badass.
All right. So let me ask you this. So, I mean, it sounds like that Tough Love, like, support group was sort of your mom's way of like also saying like, it, none of her behavior is a function of what I've done.
Yep. You got it.
What was the cult that they were in? Was she in the cult at that time? What was the cult or
well,
the new
the
religious
cult group? Was, yeah, the cult was, no, it's not a new religious group. It is a cult. The Children of God. Actually, I think if you Google cult, it's like one of the first things that come up. The Children of God, it changed its name to the Family. Rose McGowan, River Phoenix were in the same group. It makes news every so often. I think in 2005, the heir apparent made a video and killed his abuser and then shot himself. And that was like, it was like on a Law and Order episode. It's never good when it's in the news, but yeah. So my mother, believes today that, you know, this is her, that she followed a prophet, you know, that she found someone who like could talk to God, and she still believes that. I mean, she never quite left spiritually, I guess. And they have like certain, you know, cult members have certain attributes. Like they just kind of like reflexively lie to people who are on the outside because they don't understand. And so there's that kind of conditioning, when you're in that kind of group. But, I think that she just found, she found a new kind of, and they also, in the group, they also have these like really harsh punishments for, you know, any kind of like, doubt or rebellion to kind of keep people in line. So I think that on many levels, Tough Love, resonated with her when she had like a, you know, kind of, an ornery, you know, 10-year-old daughter.
Now, this isn't the Family. I mean, didn't Jeff Charlotte write a book about the Family that was?
No, that's a different group.
That's a different group. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. This was like the Family of Love, the Children of God. Yeah, that was a different group. That was a different cult.
And
yeah.
So when she went to this Tough Love support group thing, was mm-hmm. everybody else around the table like, were they like, ah, I'm a suburban family that just has a kid who's like has real problems? She's not bringing to the table that, oh, incidentally, my kid just may be reacting to the fact that like we have we belong to a cult and we do all sorts of horrible things in the cult to children. That didn't come up, it sounds like.
No, because the default position is that your children are decadent and or your children have been spoiled. And that's the problem. Like, if you have a kid,
nobody says like, hey, your kid just may be rationally reacting to a situation you put them in.
Right. Or your kid has autism, or your kid has post-traumatic stress disorder, which I believe was my main issue. You know, I mean, I had a lot of recurring nightmares and stuff. And now that I no longer have to view everything through the lens of being an alcoholic. Now it's like, oh, okay. I probably was suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. So, you know, none of that stuff. And I think that I'm not alone. I think there are a lot of kids who were misdiagnosed, because, you know, they wanted to see what they wanted to see instead of what was actually there.
And so let me ask you this, what has it done in terms of, I mean, I get a sense of like, you can sort of start to address that part of your life insofar as like, you were not a bad kid. You were just a normal kid reacting to being put in a bad situation. I would imagine there's a lot of emotional turmoil involved in that. What also about like the idea of like, you're no longer identifying yourself? I mean, it seems to me like your time in Alcoholics Anonymous was like a big part of your support structure and identity. I mean, I think you said on the This American Life thing that it actually ended up saving your life.
I mean, it became my family. Whenever I accomplished something, I didn't go, you know, I didn't have parents to go to. So like, you know, when my column became syndicated, or, you know, I won an award or whatever, I would go to an AA meeting to cheer about it. You know, it was my default. It was my family. It was my community. It was where I belonged. And so like, I was also risking that by drinking. Just to circle back, I mean, you know, your question about the emotional turmoil, I mean, Nancy Updike pointed this out to me, and I was unaware. You know, she said that, because she listened to all my speaker tapes.
She's the producer who did the piece for This American Life.
Yeah. And so she said, you know, you are the villain in all of your stories. And, you know, most people are the protagonists of their own stories, and I was the opposite. And the thing about AA, they would say, you know, I'd sit in meetings and they would say, you know, there are no victims over 18. And I was like, yeah, but I'm under 18, but I'm really mature for my age. So, you know, I took responsibility for everything. And when you have responsibility for things, you can regret. And once you can regret, you have like this delusion of control and power. Like, if I didn't do this as a 4-year-old, then maybe this would not have happened. And so I took responsibility for every horrible thing that, you know, allegedly horrible thing that I did as a kid, and decided that I was going to make amends for it. And I was going to, you know, do good deeds in order to make up for this. And then I, you know, after I actually had a drink of alcohol, I found one day myself Googling the phrase child abuse. And I was reading about kids who are emotionally abused, and it said that kids who are emotionally abused often blame themselves. Now, I fully knew this intellectually. Like, every time I saw someone who was, you know, a beaten housewife would say, you know, oh, I deserved it. I was mouthing off. And I'm like, no, that's not okay. But I had never applied that to myself, where I was kind of taking responsibility for everything that had ever happened in my family. And didn't realize that that's exactly what I was doing. And so, to answer your question, it is liberating to not be no longer the villain, but be no longer responsible for everybody else's problems. It makes me feel kind of humiliated that it took this long, but, you know, I mean, I was busy surviving,
right,
essentially, but like, yeah, I mean, it's like, it's freeing. I mean, I really do feel like I walk down the street and I'm 150 pounds lighter. You know, I mean, it's like the feeling is astronomical. I can't even describe it.
Wow. That's amazing. And what about, is there some sense of loss? Like, have you gone back to any AA meetings? Is there some sense of loss there in terms of like the identification you forged in the context of AA?
You know, you would think, but no, I don't feel, I feel like, you know, this is like that the world has opened to me, and I'm figuring out things that were not true. And then I'm also figuring out things that are true, and things that I rationalized for years, I no longer have to spend the energy trying to make things fit. You know, the people who I am really close to who are still in AA, I'm still really still close to. I didn't lose any friends. I probably lost some people who were never really, you know, like my acquaintances, may not talk to me, but that's okay. But yeah, more there's just elation. I might just be at that phase of it, but like, no, the loss, isn't there whatsoever. I think before I came out of the closet, I was afraid of being found out and gossiped about, but now that's over.
That you were afraid that the people in AA would be gossiping, like, she doesn't think that she's an alcoholic, that type of thing?
Or right, or like, you know, or hoping that I would, you know, essentially hoping I would fail, right? Because there's like the moderation management, the woman who founded moderation management killed someone by drunk driving. And so everyone gets to be smug about that. Because moderation management clearly doesn't work because, you know, I know someone who it didn't work for and whatever. So, you know, there's that kind of like, because I'm putting myself out there in a very, very public way, you know, I essentially am, you know, there's like a part of them that it's like wants me to essentially fail to, you know, kind of reinforce that narrative.
Right.
So there's a bit of that, but mainly it's just, you know, I want my story to, or I want to be able to talk about the troubled teen industry and foster care system and all the stuff that I have not been able, I knew about intimately, but I've not been able to talk about or write about because I'm not out of the closet, you know, because it's like this long, weird story that I just didn't want to get into because I wanted to write about like Congress or whatever, you know, was more interesting to me than the stuff of where I came from. Like I was trying to run away from that, as fast as possible.
Yeah. At some level, now, like your delusion, I mean, was it you were trying to protect the identity, or did the identity prevent you from actually perceiving it? You know what I'm saying?
Like my my public persona versus
the narrative that your narrative you have of your own life over that time. I mean, it's amazing because you have none of the facts of your life have really fundamentally changed. It's just that you actually are seeing them as they really are.
Right. Yeah. Right. That's exactly it.
Dude, why are you writing that book right now?
I am. I am. I'm, you know, I mean, if there are any publishers listening, I haven't found one.
Are you kidding? Are you serious?
I just haven't had any offers yet. I mean, it's been 5 days.
Do you need a literary agent? Because I guess what I just started doing, becoming a literary agent.
Are you a literary agent?
I am
today.
You want
15% of this? Okay.
Are you kidding? It's an amazing story. I mean, I remember you've been talking about writing a book about it, but that was, you know, before you realized that you had your old narrative, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, here's the honest truth and why I didn't want to write the book is because my story was that I was a really bad kid and I was afraid that when I wrote the book, everyone would sympathize with my poor mother who had to deal with me.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, it's dark, right? So, you know, and then it wasn't until I started thinking about this and my husband was like, you know, you're not a mean person and you're pretty emotionally even keeled. You don't have highs and lows and you're also,
didn't your husband say to you, like, at one point, like, I got news for you, with all due respect, your mom was a jackass?
Yeah, all the time.
Oh, okay.
All the time.
But you know, that's the thing. People never listen to their husbands, is what my experience is.
Yeah, that's, you know, it's probably a good practice. But, you know, I mean, his job was not to, like, you know, shake me awake. His job was just to kind of go, like, you know, like, I'm here with you. Like, whatever you need, I we'll deal with it when it comes. And, you know, I mean, so yeah, it's been a long, jarring process, but like, you know, I feel like now I have an opportunity to, you know, talk about issues of poverty and foster care and kids who, you know, are in the system. I don't know if there's anybody who has really gone through what I've gone through who has a profile or, you know, a public platform like I do. I feel like I'm in a unique position, and I haven't really taken advantage of that because I've been afraid to tell everybody about, you know, just the weird crap that I had to go through.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so how did you end up, like, on This American Life? You were like, I'm going to have a drink, and then I'm going to call This American Life.
Well, I mean, you know, I went through this whole thing, and then I wrote an essay that it's actually, I hope, and I think it's still going to be published in Marie Claire in February. But so I wrote this essay about the whole process and what, like, the revelation afterward. I mean, essentially, after I realized I was an alcoholic, I'm like, if I'm not an alcoholic, I'm an abused child. And that's, you know, it's, you know, one or the other, because right. Like, if I'm an alcoholic, everything that my parents did was for the greater good, because they were trying to save my life through these really harsh conditions. And look, I'm sober, so they mission accomplished. But after years of sitting in AA meetings, where, like, when you know, families make this sacrifice and kind of, you know, detach, then they come back and they reunite with the alcoholic. But that never happened for me. They just right. never came back. And it was like, okay, well, this is weird.
That was
this
a tip
not
off.
Exactly. Yeah, right. I was like, no, this is not exactly how it goes.
And how come none of these other families belong to a cult where they bring their kids on their hip and, I mean,
exactly.
do all this crazy effed up stuff?
Right. Exactly. So yeah. Anyway, I wrote, so I had this kind of realization, and it was pretty, like, you know, it's pretty gnarly. Anyway, I wrote it, and then a friend of mine who worked in Morning Edition read it, and he was like, you have to send this to This American Life. And I've been a huge fan of This American Life for years, and I sent it to one of the producers, and then, you know, Nancy Updike, who I'm also a huge fan of, emailed me and said, would you like to come into the studio? And I mean, Sam, we had like 8 hours of an eight hour interview over 2 days.
Wow.
And it was gnarly. It was like bloodletting.
It sounded like it, actually. I mean, it sounded, there's only, like, obviously, like, you listen to it, it's a 20 minute piece. Mm-hmm. And there's, I don't know how many actual minutes of you talking there, but it does seem like it was very emotional for you.
It was, I mean, and I was having realizations that I, you know, things that I, you know, as I was in the studio, I was saying things out loud that I had never said before, and then I had never thought about before.
And you should get those tapes, dude, for your book to write.
Right. Well, so then I start, you'll like this. So then I start crying, and, you know, and I'm snotting everywhere. And I was like, Nancy, I need some Kleenex. And so she, like, runs around the studio, and the only thing she can find is a roll of toilet paper. And I was like, okay, well, this should be like the tweet when you guys are raising money. National Public Radio, don't even have, like, make your interviewee cry, but don't even have the
toilet
decency
paper.
To have a box of Kleenex.
Tissues.
Toilet paper. So yeah, it was,
that's not the way we do it around the Majority Report. I'm holding a box of Kleenex in my hand right now.
Oh my God. Double ply, triple ply. What do you got?
Soft stuff. The soft stuff.
Yeah, it was, and then, you know, they are so, Nancy is so incredibly brilliant, and was also really emotionally involved in the story. And I think that comes across in the piece.
Yep.
Where she was very empathetic. Even though when, you know, during the fact checking process, when she had to talk to my parents, I mean, I was in a fetal position. I couldn't, you know, the whole, the kind of, like,
wait, you weren't there while she was talking to them. Were
oh,
you?
No. But I mean, I knew that was happening. And so, you know, I'm gripped in fear because, you know, my whole story is kind of based on my parents lying about me for their own purposes. And I'm terrified that they're just going to try to, you know, it's going to be about my credibility versus theirs, which, you know, had led me to be locked up when I was a kid. So this was like, you know, this really,
you're still, I mean, at some level, you're still caught in that because there, I mean, of the four people who are listening right now, to this program, There's no, you know, like the idea that anybody would take their word, but I guess that's the sort of the dynamic that you have as an 11-year-old or a 9-year-old, right?
Exactly.
Is that you still see your parents. When was the last time you spoke to your parents?
Whenever Networks Nation was in Las Vegas was the last time I talked to my mother. I was on the drive back and I realized that she was just thoroughly and bad intentioned. She has enjoyed the narrative that I was a horrible kid and that, you know, she did the best thing that she could.
I remember you telling me the story, I think, at that time.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. So I remember driving back and I had a good weekend and it was a lot of fun and I was feeling pretty good about myself. And then my mother called and she started, she wanted to relitigate something that happened when I was like 7. I don't know. It was just one of those, and it kind of occurred to me that she's never going to be nice to me. She's never going to encourage me. She's never read anything that I've ever written. She's just not a nice person. And I was like, I don't have to talk to you anymore. I don't have to have a relationship with you anymore. And if I think of you as my mother, it's actually very depressing. I'm really close with my foster parents, and that's who gave me away at my wedding, and that's who I call, you know, when I need, you know, I need advice, whether I'm going to wear pearls or rhinestones to the, you know, White House Correspondents' Dinner, like that kind of stuff. I mean, I think of them as my parents. And if I think of them as my parents, I'm a happy person. But if I think of my birth parents as my parents, it's horribly depressing.
Wow. How have they reacted to this?
My foster parents?
Yeah.
Oh, they're completely traumatized. they're so uncomfortable with having any kind of it. That's an interesting question. So when I was a blonde-haired, blue-eyed, bookish foster kid, there were people lined up who wanted me to like be their spokesperson and their poster child for their whatever their little pet issue was. My foster dad protected me from a lot of that. He didn't want me to be exploited. He wanted me to have a private life. He wanted me to be able to succeed and fail in private and not have to have the scrutiny of publicity on my life decision. And that was really important to him. So, and he's also a very private person and he also doesn't feel like it's his place to disclose anything about me. So when the fact checkers called him, that really stressed them out. Mm-hmm. It was like this weird irony that like the people who were, you know, did horrible things to me were the ones who were like kind of, you know, cool with it. And then the people who were my, the people who saved me were the ones who were actually being, traumatized by the fact checkers.
It also sounds like they're the most protective of you.
That exactly. And that was, you know, from the very, the first time when I first met them, I realized that that's really what they wanted to do was like things in my best interest and protect me, which was something, that I had never experienced with my birth family at all.
And
this is horrible. I can't believe that people are actually listening to this. This feels like I'm just talking to you on the phone. Oh, this is...
How did they react to, I mean, did they feel, have you talked to them about like that they didn't have, do they feel bad that they didn't have the awareness to tell you? I mean, obviously you couldn't expect them to, right? Because it was your narrative. There's no reason for them to question it. Certainly a foster parent's not going to go like, hey, you know, you're 15 now. Let's see if you can drink.
Right.
I mean, but on some level, I mean, have they said like, gosh, we wish that we had, you know, sort of questioned the narrative that you were delivered to us with, or?
No, I mean, I think that because they weren't able to, you know, after I aged out, they were still busy with other kids. And so like, they couldn't be, you know, we couldn't be close until they were retired. So like they kind of err on the side of sobriety anyway. They think that like,
right.
You know, so what I didn't have to drink fluorescent blue stuff and puke that color when I was in 21. You know, like, that's not a huge loss. They feel like, you know, they kind of erred on the side of sobriety, which was fine. And I also found a community. And, you know, so I don't think that they regret that. I agree with that on some level. But, you know, there's a part of me that's like, you know, it's almost like a consolation prize. Like I was told at 13 that I was a diabetic, for example. And then, you know, I'm told that like, if I eat cake, I will die. And so I just don't. And then one day I decide that like, maybe that's not true. And I decide to eat cake. And then I go, wait a second, I'm not a diabetic. And they go, yeah, but you know, you ate better.
Right.
And it's like, okay. But you know, there's nothing I can do about that now. And I did, you know, I did find, you know, people who cared about me, and I found a place where I could belong. Now, I don't think that, I don't think the standards should be lowered for young people as far as, you know, alcoholism. I think that there are people who are 16 years old who end up in AA who absolutely belong there.
Right.
I think that, it could be different now, but when I got there, it was kind of the, you know, everybody was in recovery for everything. And, there was this kind of feeling that like the 12 steps would kind of heal all ailments. So if you got to AA and did the 12 steps, you were better off than people who didn't. And there was that kind of, feeling where now, you know, there's been a bit of a sea change in at least the recovery movement. There's questioning new data as to like how we view alcoholics, and, you know, and there's a lot of kids who have problems as teenagers. And then once they, you know, get a job, graduate college, they, you know, no longer have those same issues. There's a lot more of, there's been research on that. There's been research about drug addiction and the kind of like old trope that, you know, you smoke crack once, then you're a crackhead. That, you know, that's actually not true, that it's the lack of opportunity that get people, you know, doing crack. And there's a movement to, in California, I think it was Proposition 47, that to not to lock people away for the rest of their lives just because they were found with drugs or drug addicts or whatever. So there's a different way of viewing these issues than there were when I got, you know,
right.
I'm doing air quotes, sober.
Wow. It's an unbelievable story, Tina.
It's intense.
Well, thanks, Sam.
It's obviously a little bit bigger than a story, but but I guess, do you have a movie recommendation for us?
I asked you this follow-up question yesterday. I said, you know, is it like something in the theater or? Last night.
It's streaming.
Okay.
Well, because you know the whole premise of this, right? I mean, we've been down this road before.
No. Hello, darkness.
But
my
I did.
Friend.
Yeah. Wow. I mean.
Okay.
Well,
can I
ask
the question
for you, Tina? Let me just say that before we move on to the film part.
So no. Okay. Thank you. I appreciate that, Sam. And this was a very enlightening conversation. I'm thank you for doing it. Yesterday I went to my one of my favorite drag queens, Hedda Lettuce, hosts the Chelsea Classics in Chelsea on Thursdays, and there was the they played The Birdcage and one the Robin Williams Nathan Lane film,
right?
And the person who did the makeup on the film was there to talk about it, and I always thought that was a stupid film that like gave Robin Williams an excuse to be swishy. And it was just like, and it is kind of a depressing film, but what the makeup person pointed out was that in order to like sell the relationship between Nathan Lane and Robin Williams, Robin Williams like was touching Nathan Lane in every scene. Like they were very physically close in order to kind of sell the love story between these two characters, and like that they had been together for over 20 years, and you know, and they get like gay married, like 90s style gay married in the film. And it's actually really touching. And so it was a completely different way of watching this film that I think I really didn't like when I saw it, when it came out.
Interesting.
So that's my recommendation.
Is that a movie I could show my 9-year-old daughter?
If you wanted her to end up in rehab at 13, yeah. No, it's, yeah, you know, it's pretty, it's, no, it's, you know, I, maybe wait until she's 12.
I can wait. We can wait to watch that if she, if that's not going to be a...
I didn't know one of the requirements for the movie recommendation was that a nine-year-old had to enjoy it.
No, I mean, I'm just looking because, you know, we get in there and it's, you know, it's movie night tomorrow.
And you're
night.
Tired of watching Frozen?
Well, we'll probably end up watching Malevolent.
Oh, man. Okay.
It's yeah. just it's out now on iTunes, and she's been waiting a long time for that.
That's harsh, man.
That's my life.
Okay. Yeah, that's, I don't know.
Now you can go out and drink.
Right.
Now you can go out and party. Tina.
Yeah, that's me. I'm going to go clubbing.
Well, yeah, I mean, the people don't... do people drink that ever drink that fluorescent blue liquor? In, other than like in, like,
I have no idea what she's talking about. Actually, I don't know what that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I don't know.
Your whole notion of the drinking culture came from that movie Cocktail.
Yeah, pretty much. That's probably true. Probably true.
Well, Tina, thanks for talking to us about it. We didn't really plan to have that big of a conversation, but it's fascinating.
Oh yeah, I know. I thought we were going to talk about my column or politics, but it ended up being a therapy.
We'll get into the atheist stuff. I have a feeling we're going to.
We are.
What?
What atheist stuff?
Well, when you were.
Oh, I'm an atheist apologist.
Yeah, what? Exactly.
I am.
Think over under God. Excuse
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Okay, you have to read the whole thing because, you can't just go by the headline.
Well, that's all. That's what we do around here. That's the way we attack people. All right, Tina. Well, we'll do this again soon, and I'll be in touch for our coffee session.
Awesome. Thanks, Sam.
All right.
Have a
bye,
good weekend.
Tina Dupuy, folks. Bye. TinaDupuy.com. Ladies and gentlemen, where you can get links to all her columns, and man, she better get on that book. It's an amazing. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. When we come back, Cliff Schechter. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, it is casual Friday around these parts. I guess some of you living in Australia, maybe it's not casual Friday for you anymore. Maybe it's just late Saturday night. But for the rest of us, it's casual Friday. And that means this guy is on, which means that this song plays before he appears on the phone.
Cliff Schechter. Libertas LLC. New media, public relations, and strategy. You want any of these services, you know who you gotta see. Cliff Schecter, Libertas LLC.
Yes, it's Casual Friday, and Cliff Schecter's on the phone. And just to prove, I got to say, Cliff, right now, I think this is the first time in ages that I have not worn even a soft-collared shirt. I am wearing a T-shirt today. I am that casual.
Wow, man.
Yeah,
you're
I've been
taking
sick.
This whole Casual Friday thing pretty damn seriously, don't you think?
Yeah, I've been very sick, and so this is the way that I strike back in my illness. I only wear a T-shirt, so.
So that you strike back at your illness by wearing a T-shirt?
Yeah.
So if you got Ebola, you'd like go naked?
Pardon?
So if you got Ebola, you'd go naked?
Definitely. Of course okay. I would. I think people know that. That was why.
Just carrying on the metaphor, you know what I mean? Trying to get an idea of how bad the illness has to be and what manner you'd strike back.
That's why people were so ambivalent about Ebola coming to New York, because it would have.
Yeah. Oh, Sammy, you're funny.
So, Cliff.
Yes.
The day after the midterms, President Obama came out and said he was still going ahead with executive action on immigration. We took that as a pretty good sign. But, you know, I don't know that we would have predicted a week later that this it's quite clear to me that there is a sort of a more comprehensive strategy in operation. And let's talk about that, because this week, I mean, over the past 2 weeks, we've had President Obama come out for net neutrality. He has come out for this executive action, and he's doubled down on it. Today, or maybe last night, in Miramar, he was asked the question about immigration, executive action, and he reiterated it. He also slammed the vote on Keystone Pipeline, and not just sort of slamming on procedural grounds, but saying, like, look, this isn't going to change gas prices in this country one iota. This is not going to do anything for America.
I've got a theory about all this, Sam.
Well, wait a second. We still got a long list here.
Go ahead.
It seems to me. Wait, what was the we've got this deal in China. Now,
in China, that's right.
It's not binding, but it's a political deal going forward, and it has genuine implications going into Paris. And then the Treasury Department yesterday comes out and says we're going to do a pilot program to go around the Department of Education, where we're going to get rid of debt collectors to see if we, at least we can implement this policy of loaning money, which I would rather see us just do free college education. But, and on top of that, and maybe, you know, you correct me if I'm wrong, the Senate bringing Elizabeth Warren in a leadership position that they have now sort of, I guess, made for her.
Yep.
Let's talk about how all real this is, but even it's real, even if it is just sort of politics.
Right. My theory, at least from Obama's perspective, is that this is the equivalent of Bill Clinton getting impeached. You may remember when he was impeached, how quickly he started moving to the left to try to shore up support. I guess it was such a strike to him that happened. And I think in a manner of speaking, it's the same thing that this was for Obama. That's such a huge repudiation. And as you just said, see, this is the thing that is a little sort of maddening, which is it's not just about policy. They're doing everything that we want them to be doing right now. Again, this can be fleeting because we've talked about, remember when they were talking about income inequality and then it went away? So, I mean, let's not sit here and assume any of this stuff's a done deal until we see it. But you know, this is what we thought when we elected him in 2008, that he'd come out like this, guns blazing, you know, and talk a progressive game and fight. I mean, it's in the feistiness of his language. They're using actual smart messaging. They're not saying, oh, you know, so Congress is a problem, you know, as opposed to Republicans are a problem. Oh, you know, there's a little bit on the left, a little bit on the right. You know, everybody is fighting here, and I'm above that. This is actually doing what we've always thought had to be done, and which we know from both electoral results, from people like George Lakoff and others that analyze, you know, and Drew Weston, the political mind and cognitive reasoning and all this, which is, human beings have learned over generations by stories. We need stories. All right. We need to know who's the good guy, who's the bad guy, who's helping us, how are they helping us, who hurt us, how did they hurt us? You know, that there needs to be better known as a narrative. And this is just not existed. It didn't exist for President Obama, and frankly couldn't exist after his U-turn on so many policies, from the biggest one being the grand bargain and austerity, which was, because you're saying the exact opposite of what you were saying a year or two ago. We don't know what the hell you stand for. And then you see it also happening on the Senate level with Elizabeth Warren, which is great because, again, we do have these three dunderheads in Manchin and McCaskill. Who's the third idiot? There were three of them who came out and, oh, you know, we need to be bipartisan and we needed to help the Republican agenda. You know, it's like these couple are so stupid they can't watch what just happened. All that triangulating worked brilliantly for Mark Pryor, didn't it? Mm. I mean, you just want to go to Claire McCaskill and be like, are you really stupid? I mean, how much evidence do you need before you get this? It wouldn't seem to be that tough. Or I guess Landrieu's the third one right now. But, I mean, I don't even blame her as much because she's in dire straits down there. She's probably just throwing anything against the wall. But, I mean, you know, because McCaskill, it's more I'm thinking about 2016, and clearly she is too. And if she learned anything from this election, she'd position herself more in a manner of Merkel and Franken and do things and actually fight for things people care about than this faux centrism garbage. But besides them, yeah, it seems to be the leadership, at least in the Senate, gets it. They certainly understand, wow, what Elizabeth Warren is saying is really popular among our voters. It's polling amazingly. It's also really popular among white working class voters who often vote Republican and are independent. What a shocker. So they say they see getting her in messaging is an important thing, and it appears the Obama White House, are we finally done with the Roms and the Dalys and the Geithners and the Summers, and you know we can go on and on and on about the idiotic sort of meet them three quarters of the way, have no message for who you are, why you exist, and why you're elected. I mean, obviously my frustration is coming out here because it's great that they're doing that now, and it's hugely important for 2016. In the meantime, I guess we'll get some executive actions, and that's great, too. It's just when you think of what could have been, it's very, very tough to get past that. That none of this stuff, if we'd been answering people's concerns and speaking to their anxieties and offering concrete policies and a narrative around it, 2010 didn't have to happen. In fact, it could have been in exactly the opposite direction. And so that's what's so – but, you know, I guess I'll throw that aside as I have to and say, yeah, do I like – I mean, I like that he's – speaking about net neutrality and immigration, there's a narrative around it. It's not a full narrative yet. I think they need to do more, but that, you know, Republicans can't just, he said this just the other day when he was talking about immigration and talking about Keystone, which is they can't just, if we disagree on one thing, they can't just throw everything out and behave that way, that there's a number of things that need to be done. And essentially, he didn't use the word. They need to act like adults about it. I mean, he's sort of putting blame where it deserved, explaining why he stood for what he stood for, even, you know, with the Keystone thing, that it wouldn't even really create jobs or bring down gas prices.
Right.
Because no one's ever told people that. Basically, this thing will create what? Like a few hundred permanent jobs?
A couple, maybe not even. I think it's somewhere, I don't know. The State Department, I think it had it. Maybe it was a couple hundred, maybe a little bit less.
Right. But, I mean, most of the jobs are fleeting. I mean, it's nice to get people back to work in any way possible, but you know, it'll be a lot better than this big, disgusting pipeline that'll blow up into people's farmland and everywhere else. Would be infrastructure projects that would get people back to work for a much longer term. And that would be great.
And the irony is, too, we should say that, a lot of that pipeline has already been built. in at least the southern part of the United States, or the mid, you know, the southern leg, I should say, of that pipeline. So there's not going to be a lot of jobs that emanate from this. But let me talk about the immigration thing. Just so that people know, I don't think we had an opportunity to report on what is in the offing.
Right.
Now, they are still – my understanding is that they're still – it is unclear exactly what they're going to do. So, you know, nobody's celebrating quite yet. But there are certainly people who are close to the administration who believe this is going to impact 5 million undocumented immigrants in this country. It is an executive action that'll basically, create under the auspices of prosecutorial discretion, because of course, if we could arrest all whatever it is, 12 million undocumented immigrants in this country and deport them, it would have happened already, theoretically.
Right.
Here it is: many parents of children who are American citizens or legal residents will be able to obtain legal work documents and will no longer worry about, living in the shower, the shadows. That's could have impact about 3.5 million people. People who have been living in the United States without papers for at least 5 years. And then there's people should also note that the White House, like I say, is still contemplating a stricter policy that would limit benefits to people who've lived in the country for 10 years, which would only be about 2.5 million people. But, you know, I was watching Hayes last night. He made a very good point. It's not like from a political standpoint, you're going to pay a significantly different price on the downside for 3.5 million people as opposed to 2.5 million people, or 3 million people as opposed to 5 million people. There's also a potential for including protections for farm workers who have entered the country without papers but have employed for years in the agricultural industry, et cetera. So, I mean, ultimately, you're talking about 5 million people. And what's fascinating is this is, you know, I don't think that this is a function of the repudiation. He may not have taken these steps in the event that the Democrats had maintained the Senate. But what's clear to me, and, you know, I don't want to overstate the policy implications of this. But from a political standpoint, the Democrats, both in the Senate and in the White House, had decided that they are going to position themselves as the opposition. You know, it's sort of like,
right,
it's a little bit counterintuitive because the Democrats have the presidency, but they are going to position themselves as the party out of power. And to a certain extent, they are, but not fully.
Well,
but and this is what is encouraging
it's
to me.
Smart
it's just
for 2016,
that,
definitely, and good policies in the meantime. So let me let you continue. Go ahead.
Well, but that's the point, is that, you know, you bring Warren into the leadership. That, you know, people are worried, is this going to co-opt her? You know, that's she's not going to get co-opted because of that. It's going to give her another platform. And they know that she is going to motivate people on the left. And the Democrats have moved into an oppositional stance where they have not really been in since, you know, 06 and before. Right. And that is the and that's good news insofar as the president actually follows through on these executive actions.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, the President Bush did a whole lot by executive action. And it's funny they weren't complaining then. I'm shocked by that. I know you are, too. And there's a lot that could be done. And again, it's important all around. It's important because these are great policies. They're as good as they can be, at least in this context, and they're needed. But at the same time, you know, they are what sets the narrative and tells people what you are for. And success builds upon success, and then people actually believe that you want to do the things you say you want to do. A lot of us have kind of wondered for a long time why some of these things weren't done sooner. So, I think it's a good thing to see again. I'm going to sort of reserve, you know, getting too excited until I make they, you know, they follow through, because there have been a few times in the past that we have not. But it's with the exception again of those few in the Senate, at least we're seeing with both the White House and with the Senate leadership that they seem to have some understanding of what just happened and are heading in the right direction. And if it's not just, well, we lost, if it's just, well, this is all we can do, that's fine too. As long as as long as Elizabeth Warren and not Claire McCaskill is handling your messaging, then I'm happy. So it's a smart direction for the party.
I mean, and not to get off track here, because I want to continue to talk about, like, you know, how the Republicans are going to react to this and the implications of this being, you know, another sort of false start, as it were. But Claire McCaskill, it occurs to me she is positioning for vice presidential run. When I hear this stuff, that's the only thing that occurs to me when she says that. Now, I may be way off base on that, but
no, I think that there could be a couple things going on at the same time. I think she could be positioning herself for that. Although I mean, if that is true, that one doesn't make as much sense to me, because I mean, assuming again things go as they look like they would go, which would be Hillary Clinton as the nominee. And if Hillary Clinton were not the nominee, the most likely person who would knock her off would be Elizabeth Warren. Again, politics is crazy. All sorts of things that, you know, at this point, and you know, back, you know, in 2006, I don't think any of us thought President Obama was, or then Senator Obama was going to seriously run. I don't remember what the time schedule was, but point being that we don't know, and somebody could come out of the woodwork. Who knows, right? But certainly, if it's any of the two leading contenders right now who are women, I don't think you're going to see a double woman ticket. I think I'd be happy with it. I'm not criticizing it. I'd be quite happy with it. I just don't think I don't think that they're willing to go quite that far outside of the box. They're a little too cautious for that up there. But the other thing is, you know, she is running for re-election in 2 years, and her numbers were terrible in 2010. I mean, she would have lost. Todd Akin is why she didn't lose. It's nothing she did. You know, it's all about the rape comment in 2010. And so clearly she seems to think, well, now I just need to be more of a fake Republican. She has not learned what others seem to be learning. And guess what? In 2016, when there's so many seats that are going to be in play, with a Democrat, with the kind of turnout we're going to have, and the crazy 2010 class up for re-election in states where they're way too conservative for the states they're in places like Illinois and New Hampshire and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Florida, you know, Missouri is somewhere further down, way further down on that list when it comes to, you know, I mean, obviously not the DSCC that protects incumbents, but overall, all of us. And, you know, she learns these lessons, she'll find herself, even in a big presidential year like that, out of a job if she learns the wrong lessons, which, again, she seems to be.
So now what happens in the Republican caucus at this point? I mean, you know.
Holy war?
I mean, honestly, you know, Boehner was out there, you know, edging up to impeachment if the president goes through with this executive action. I mean, it seems to me, I mean, you bring up that Clinton had to tack to the left when he was impeached because he needed the support from the left. And I think in this instance, President Obama is actually sort of like tacking to the left, or at least getting, you know, engaging in this executive action to talk them into impeaching him.
Yeah, that's what I like too, is because in the past, you know, the caution of, I mean, we would respond to what Republicans say as if they won't go and do something bad anyhow. Oh, they're threatening me, so I'd better not do it, you know, which is instead of bring it on, as George W. Bush so brilliantly said, you know, go ahead and do it. It worked brilliantly for you guys in the past. One, you know, the shutdown clearly worked amazingly for you a year or two ago. I mean, frankly, if, you know, maybe we'd be having a different conversation if the rollout of, you know, the online Obamacare of the website had been such a disaster, which made everybody forget about their shutting down the government when the Republican Party was tanking. I mean, obviously there's other factors there too. But every time they shut the government down, as they did with Bill Clinton, every time they've impeached, their numbers fall through the ground. People don't want that. But they live in a bubble, and they speak to the same people who are just like them, which is why they make all the gaffes they make and say all the most politically incorrect things, because in their circles these are acceptable things to say and do. And the interesting thing is going to be, look at how Boehner has been tortured the last couple of years, and I've enjoyed it. I don't feel sorry for him in the slightest, by the lunatics who just don't care, who are willing to blow this country up to get their way. And you now have what I would call a solid suicide bomber caucus among the Republicans. I mean, it's not just Ted Cruz saying crazy stuff anymore. He actually may be kind of middle of the road among the Republican caucus. Joni Ernst and Cory Gardner and Ben Sasse and Tom Cotton and some of these people start opening their mouths, and the crazy that's going to come out. And I don't think they're going to be satisfied. And, I don't know if it'll be impeachment. McConnell may be able to find ways, censure Obama or do other things.
Well, they're going to try and shut down the government first, I think.
Right, but there's that. He's going to have to do stuff like that. Maybe I don't want to impeach, so I guess I have to shut down the government. The point is, he's going to have to find what is a middle ground to the Republican caucus, which, to anywhere else in the modern world is sort of, not Mussolini, but Franco. I mean, that's kind of what you're looking at. They're going to do something crazy, not something completely crazy. Or something completely crazy, not something batshit crazy.
I think when President Obama signs this executive action, he should entitle it the Ted Cruz Promotional Act. Because Cruz is going to – I mean, this is what Ted Cruz has been sort of praying for.
He's been living for this, of course.
The one who's going to get out there and say, look at the lemmings and the weakness in the Republican Party.
That's right.
And it's going to give him the ability to strut around, and it's going to be fantastic.
And Mike Lee, his sort of henchman. And the thing is, nothing has changed since, we just had an election. Wow. The broader structure of what's created this Republican Party, this crazy cult-like group of people, has not changed, because you still have – the right, you still have a 24-hour news station that is so far the right, it's crazy, that gives, that argues and replaces fact with opinion, whether it's climate change or it's women's rights or it's the minimum wage or it's Social Security or it's guns or it's anything. They basically give their version of reality and tell people, if your Republican senator or congressman isn't following this version of reality, they're really a Democrat. Rush Limbaugh is doing the same thing 3 hours a day, as are all the others like Glenn Beck and the rest of them. And then so in the free media universe, it's the loudest, rightest, craziest voices who all profit off of doing this stuff and couldn't care a whit about this country are not going to change. And then there's the selfish voices of the Koch brothers and, I can't remember, Art Pope in North Carolina and the DeVosses and all these rich right-wing Republican families, Foster Freese, and they all essentially want to do two things, which is take rights away from every group that has them and enrich themselves, more importantly. And the Ted Cruzes and the people like that are the ones that argue for the kinds of things that in the long term they see it benefits them. In the short term, they could, you're not talking about now like a Wall Street hedge funder or something. You're talking about multi-billionaire, Koch brothers who, if the market tanks in the short term or something, they lose a bunch of money. But in the long term, if the result of that market tanking, once the market comes back, is that they're deregulated even further, the EPA is hamstrung even further, and a variety of other things, they make money off of it. So they don't care about the short-term destruction of this country. They care about the long-term. When you've got it both on the paid media side and the earned media side, you've got, the equivalent of billions of dollars going against you in all day broadcasting, radio, TV, the rest of it. And that's not even getting into all the crazy groups like the NRA with their mailing lists that send these conspiratorial emails about any Republican. I mean, we've seen it. We've seen it with the Dick Lugers and the George Voinoviches and the Republicans that got kicked out or had to leave because they were only center right. That's what you're looking at. So, there's no reason why this dynamic would change.
No, it's not going to change. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's there was a good piece by Professor Jay Rosen, basically saying to journalists, stop saying Republicans have to govern now. They don't. They won't, and they don't have to, because their incentive structure is such this way. You know, it's funny. When you were talking about how all the forces, and we've talked about this many times, the industry that is in some ways keeps pulling the Republicans to the right.
I should have also, I'll just say in 2 seconds, I should have also mentioned that the print, you know, outlets, your Human Events, Newsmax, Daily Caller. I mean, I mentioned, you know, but that all goes with it all.
There's just too much money in the business of pulling Republicans to the right. It's irrelevant as to whether or not they can get, elected to national office. Although, you know, at this point, certainly during the midterm elections, there's even less disincentive for them to do this. I remember a piece by, I think the guy was writing for The Atlantic at the time, and I think, if it's not, I apologize in advance, but I think it was Josh Green or Joshua Green, I'm not sure.
Right.
Who had written a piece in 2004. Liberals should be careful because, you don't want Air America to be, to become as strong as something like Limbaugh, because Limbaugh is the death knell for the Republican Party. He's going to pull them way to the right. Now, 10 years later, the reality is that we haven't seen them go fully over that cliff yet. They're certainly still marching in that regard.
Yeah, but that the blame for that lies also with the Democrats.
Of course.
They marched over that cliff far enough by 2008 during Bush's presidency in enough ways they had destroyed this country that if Obama had come into office talking like the way he's talking now, and if the Democrats elevated the people like Elizabeth Warren then that they're elevating now, and if that was their message and they'd stuck strong to a progressive vision of how they could help people's lives, you know, re-regulate the economy to work for regular people and things like that. I mean, I think, again, I've said this many times before, and I nothing's changed my belief, that instead of what we saw would have been like 1934 was for FDR, which was almost a bigger win than 32 because the Republicans were wiped out in that midterm election. I think you see something completely different, and history is different. You know, so I think they've marched. I mean, you're right. They're going to keep marching further until somebody stops them, because sanity isn't going to stop
them. Well, but here's
marched
the point.
Far enough that if we take advantage of it, you know, they could have been ended as a party in 2008.
Here's what drives me crazy: the establishment media, the left of center media, who says like, look, you know, this notion of President Obama being able to do X, Y, and Z through this supposed bully pulpit is so-called Green Lanternism, which is this idea where you think that the president has these magical powers, and by going out and saying a couple of things, he can cause certain things to happen. These people just largely say it's predetermined. There are structural forces. It doesn't matter what Obama says. Simultaneously, these are the same people who say the Republican Party cannot continue in this manner because they're driving themselves too far to the right. And they're going to have to lead. They're going to have to govern now. They're going to be in trouble because they're going to be in a position where they now have power and they're going to be seen by the American public as, being the sort of the incapable of leading. What bothers me about this is that these are flip side arguments, and they subscribe to one side of the coin, but not the other. The reality is that what President Obama is doing now, and like you say, and like I've said, it remains to be seen whether or not this is carried through and these policies are actually executed as they're being sold now. But what he's doing now is he is driving a wedge into the Republican Party, and he is forcing them to accelerate the speed in which they run towards that cliff. Where they get where Ted Cruz is now going to move so far out in front to delineate himself from these weak-kneed Republicans that, and they're all going to follow him. And eventually they will get so far out there that they doom themselves. That is the strategy that is clearly being undertaken right now by the Democrats.
That's right. Right. And again, my problem with that theory, and yes, it does come from certain center left and centristy quarters, you know, people that say they're for Obama, but and really actually it was in some ways are more reflexively pro-Obama than you or
Yeah, definitely.
I mean, because I guess definitely they are. You're right. Because it's Green Lantern and all that. And I mean, that thing is so easy to take apart from the moment it's uttered that it's almost like frustrating that you have to. But I suppose we have to. We're seeing it right now. I mean, people like you and I never was saying there weren't structural objects in front of Obama. We set up our democracy that way over 200 years ago. We gave rural people in rural areas outsized power and people in smaller states outsized power for reasons back then, because we had to get the country together. And it's caused us a lot of problems since then. I mean, California is the size of, an average of about 7 or 8 states in this country, but gets only 2 senators. You know, I mean, these have been, these are problems. At the same time, executive actions, appointments, rhetoric, and if anybody wants to claim that you think the bully pulpit works, it doesn't, whatever. I mean, are they paying attention to the same country and the way the media works that I am? I mean, you don't even need the bully pulpit. The bully pulpit would have been an amazing thing to have. But look at how the conventional wisdom, and I'll say this, and an issue I've worked on and I've seen it, on Social Security has changed. And look at how it's changed just from all the prominent people that came out and started advocating for increasing it. You know, people in the media such as Paul Krugman, people in politics such as Elizabeth Warren, and many others, and some people trace it all back to Duncan Black, who you've had on your show many times, for writing things in USA Today that reached people.
Right.
There's a lot of people that are on the left and, who write for very mainstream publications. There used to be a point, a time in the past where you could have said, well, you're confined to blogs, or only the people who are on your side are reading you. That's no longer the case. There are a lot of people who grew up writing for blogs 10 years ago, who write for a lot of very mainstream publications now, who can get their ideas out, provide proof, and show where what we're saying makes sense. There's, on top of that, there are people in government who are stalwart progressives who can stand. There's Elizabeth Warren or Sherrod Brown or Bernie Sanders or many people like that can stand. Many more in the House. The House Progressive Caucus is a hell of a lot bigger than the New Democrats or you combine the New Democrats and Blue Dogs, you maybe start coming close. But people don't know that because we're in a different place than we used to be. So to claim that can't influence anything, I've also seen it on the gun issue on background checks. I mean, it's become to the point where outside of the NRA, for a Democrat to be in favor of background checks is no longer controversial.
Right.
It's just expected. This has happened. Gay marriage. Look at where that's gone. I mean, these are all things where having the president behind it helps a lot, but even the president not behind it, these issues have moved. So what I'm saying is, if he had been using that bully pulpit to stick up for this vision again and again and explain to people not that we need to tighten our belts, but we need to untighten our belts. The problem here is that the economy doesn't work like a family. The economy needs investment. There's all sorts of demand that's disappeared because of the housing bubble. We need that again. We need to do it and then play into history and emotion. Show old pictures of the WPA and what FDR did. Tell people a story. And if you've done that again and again through earned media and paid media on your 13 million member email list and through the Senate and the House and your Paul Krugmans and people like that, things would turn out differently. So the Green Lantern thing, would you get everything passed you want? No. But if you start at single payer, you end up at public option, as opposed to starting at public option and then not even fighting for it. I mean, this is all common sense, it seems to me. I don't think I ever, I ever sit here and say Obama would have gotten everything done or even 90% of it of what he wanted. But he would have gotten a lot more. And I even try to discount and include the fact in this, in my reasoning, which is that in a manner of speaking, he's had to be Jackie Robinson. I get it. He can't show the anger publicly that a white president could. All right, or God knows how much, underneath racial bigotry. I'm not talking about the outright bigots, but people that kind of are and try not to be, and how that would be appealed to on the right. I get it that he's had to do things in a different way, but it doesn't mean that he couldn't forcefully state things if not in an angry way. It doesn't mean he couldn't state his principles. There is nuance there.
Well,
and so that's why that Green Lantern thing just drives me nuts, because it's complete crap.
Well, Cliffy, I guess we'll find out next week where we're headed with all this. It could very well be we're talking about the executive action in the past tense. But until then, Cliff Schechter, always a pleasure, buddy.
Always my pleasure. Thanks for having me on, Sammy.
All right. We have a Jimmy Reefer Cake song. Am I right or am I wrong? Ladies and gentlemen, if you have not listened to this program on a regular basis, boy, we gave away another Freebie Friday. We haven't even gotten to the better half. We're going to do a separate better half after we do this Jimmy Reefer Cake song. Folks, just a reminder, if you can support this program, please, we need your support.
We shows like ours, you know, we're going to have some advertising in the coming months, but it's not going to be much. There's just simply political podcasts, particularly left-wing ones, do not get a lot of advertising. That's just the bottom line. And so there really is only one business model for us, and that is listener support. So you can become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Pennies a day. And only on this program do you get a a song nearly every week from Jimmy Reefercake from Maine. And this week he has written a – what song has he written?
It's called
– From allthehypocrisy.com.
Yes, it is called Stoned Socialist.
Yeah, Jimmy Reefercake, for those of you who are listening for the first time, Stoned Socialist.
Reefercake likes it all and recently was commissioned to produce a podcast theme song for a new podcast coming out. Commission,
nice.
Joe. This is going to pay for the...
Fantastic.
It's going to pay for the website hosting, dude.
All right. I guess apparently... is this even a song? Have you listened to this yet or no?
No, but he said it. It's a song,
I guess,
apparently.
He's throwing it down. He's basically... This sounds like an ultimatum to the Majority Report. All right, go ahead.
This is going right into the... all the hypocrisy funds.
Beauty.
It's a theme song. This name of the podcast is The Stoned Socialist.
Nice.
Let's hear that, Sata.
Awesome.
I am a stoned socialist. Stoned socialist. Not saying China's a model nation, but society demands cooperation. Everybody's body is their own, but we still gotta work together. We can't do this alone. Being a stone socialist, I'm just a stone socialist. Come on and listen, won't you listen to my podcast?
Wow, that is pretty good. There we go.
Wow. I like Jimmy's hype man.
I wonder what is this, the implications for the liberal libertarian, progressive libertarian. He's going a lot of different directions. All right, folks, we're going to say goodbye to free beers. We gave an extra. Holy cow!
We gave a full, more than a full show.
More than a full show. No.
Yeah.
We gave three times. What free beers usually get, right?
Yeah.
No, we did 99 minutes, a little more than double. Two and a half times. Wow. God, man, bad business guy. Go ahead, yeah, play the outro song. You're sticking around, members. Give us a call, 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Take your IMs. Casual Friday. We'll be back. Oh, you can get the Majority Report app at majorityapp.com. Majorityapp.com. All right, we'll be back in a minute.